The Years of Lyndon Johnson. Means of Ascent by Robert A. Caro. Continued, Cassette 8, Side 1. Chapter 11. The Flying Windmill. Out of his despair, he emerged with a new strategy. It was unveiled in the first speech he made after returning to Texas, an address over a statewide radio network that was delivered from a studio at a Houston radio station, instead of in Herman Park, customary site of political rallies, because he had been out of circulation, and his advisers felt there was now so little interest in his candidacy that attracting a crowd would be impossible, and a rally in the park only an embarrassment. In fact, Woodward had to work like a dog even to get 50 or so people to the studio. One of them, invited to fill out the crowd, was Woodward's mother. It was very different from Johnson's earlier speeches. Previously, he and his advisers had agreed that attacking Stevenson personally would be a mistake. Because of the respect, indeed almost reverence, in which the former governor was held, such attacks had always boomeranged in the past. But now, in desperation, he attacked. Stevenson had said he opposed a Truman plan to provide federal aid to raise teachers' salaries because of provisions which Stevenson feared would increase federal control of schools. On this stance, popular in Texas, Stevenson could not be criticized, but Johnson used Stevenson's statement to bring in another issue so that he could criticize the ex-governor on that one. "While I was sick at Mayo's," Lyndon Johnson said, "a calculating, do-nothing, fence-straddling opponent of mine, who 3 months ago said he had no platform, got off the fence for the first time to oppose the teacher salary increase. I challenge my calculating opponent to tell Texans tomorrow if he favors withdrawing federal aid from 500,000 World War veterans, men who did not sit at home when Old Glory had to be carried to every corner of the globe." Two aspects of Johnson's attack were significant. First, its implication, that Stevenson might be opposed to federal aid for veterans, was totally false. As Johnson was well aware, Stevenson was in favor of such aid, and indeed had already proposed that it be increased. Equally significant were the words in which the attack was couched. "Calculating, do-nothing, fence-straddling." And as the speech went on, with Johnson elaborating on his falsification of Stevenson's record, he referred to him directly, "Mr. Calculator, Mr. Do-nothinger, Mr. Straddler." Johnson's advisers were appalled. "Taking on Coke Stevenson was a very tricky thing to do," Jake Pickle recalls. "He was very popular." When, in dismay, local Johnson managers throughout the state contacted Claude C. Wilde, a veteran Texas politician who had been given the largely honorary title of campaign manager, Wilde assured them there would be no repetition. But Wilde was wrong. By the end of the week, Johnson was attacking Mr. Fence Straddler's courage. "A man ought to have the courage to stand up and say what he believes in," he said. Then he orchestrated attacks on Stevenson's honesty, having allies charged that the former governor had pardoned a record number of criminals. Johnson had hoped this charge would be effective with voters who remembered that alleged sales of pardons by a previous governor, Jim Ferguson, had become an accepted part of Texas political folklore. The Johnson camp said that the proof of the charge lay in the record number of pardons Stevenson had issued. Stevenson refused to reply to the charge, but state prison officials, queried by reporters, explained that the Johnson number had been arrived at by lumping together with true pardons 2 or 3 day passes given to convicts to attend the funerals of family members or to visit sick relatives, and pardons faded away as a campaign issue. Then Johnson circulated charges of corruption in an option that the Magnolia Petroleum Company had purchased to test for oil on land Stevenson owned. Stevenson refused to reply to this charge either. Surrounded in Austin by reporters asking for an answer, he said he would not attempt to defend his honesty. "As my private life is an open book and my record of public service is too well known to the people of Texas to require repetition. If my record does not warrant my election to the Senate, then I ought to stay at home. The people know enough to make their own choice." At the annual dinner of the Austin Press Corps, however, Stuart Long, one of Johnson's allies among the journalists, shouted a question at Stevenson about the Magnolia option while he was speaking, and Stevenson lost his temper. Turning to Long, his face set in the stone stare, his voice so low it could hardly be heard, he explained the circumstances of the lease. Since everything said at the dinner was off the record, his reply was not preserved and the details are not remembered. But reporters who were there, even Johnson's supporters, remember how ashamed Long looked when he sat down. "Well," he whispered to Horace Busby, "I guess I was sure wrong about that." And that issue, too, thereupon dropped out of the campaign. But Johnson simply continued trying other issues that were nothing more than attacks on Stevenson's integrity. Coke Stevenson's strongest point was his reputation. Lyndon Johnson had decided his only hope was to destroy it. Together with the new strategy came a new weapon. It was a helicopter. Despite their use in the war, helicopters were still almost unknown in civilian life. So far as Johnson could ascertain, no candidate had ever campaigned for political office in one. But some months earlier, Woodward, familiar with them from his Air Force service, had suggested that Johnson do so because its use would ease one of the greatest difficulties in campaigning across a state 800 miles long and almost 800 miles wide, in which half the voters still lived in small towns to which roads were often inadequate and which were so far apart that much of any campaign was wasted in traveling between them. Attending a demonstration in Washington staged for congressmen by the Bell Helicopter Corporation, Johnson had perceived an additional advantage. Few Texans had ever seen one of these strange-looking aircraft. Its arrival in a small town would be an event. Drawing crowds to campaign speeches was extremely difficult in Texas, not only because of the people's distrust of politicians, but because of the long distances they had to travel to reach a speaking, and because the time these trips took was too precious to farmers and ranchers to be wasted. Politicians had tried everything from barbecues and watermelon feasts to a special train chartered by one candidate to haul voters to a speech from all across the state, but the only attraction that had ever worked had been Pappy O'Daniel's famous hillbilly band. Maybe, Johnson felt, a helicopter could be a drawing card for him, the way the hillbilly boys had been for Pappy. Returning from the demonstration, he had told Warren Woodward, "Woody, that's the best idea I've ever heard." As Johnson had weighed the idea, however, he had come to feel that its advantages were outweighed by its drawbacks. The logistical difficulties of keeping an aircraft in operation over so vast an area were formidable. Most of this early generation of helicopters could carry fuel enough for only about 150 miles of flight, which would necessitate several refuelings every day. Helicopters could use only 90-octane gas. Some airports stocked it, some didn't. And most Texas towns didn't have an airport anyway. The helicopter, therefore, would have to be refueled from trucks, which would carry the gas in 50-gallon drums. If the helicopter missed its connection with a truck, it would be forced down. The candidate could find himself stranded in a town or a field, an object of ridicule in the press, ridicule that could be fatal to a candidacy. Fuel was only part of the problem. It was unusual for helicopters to be in the air more than an hour or two a day, and campaigning obviously demanded far more daily flying time. Not only fuel trucks, but a mechanic would have to follow the craft back and forth across Texas in case it broke down. And what if it broke down and couldn't be repaired? What if, in some remote part of Texas, a needed replacement part wasn't available? That, too, could strand a candidate. Each night the helicopter would require servicing, and then would have to be guarded against curious people wanting to handle its valves or rotors. And the crowds attracted to hear the candidate speak would be attracted not to a courthouse or a schoolhouse, but to an open area. Explains Woodward, "If you're going to land in a field, there's no electrical sockets out there, and you had to find some way to get your sound system wired in." So many things could go wrong in the daily hurly-burly of even a traditional campaign. Why add to the normal difficulties the problems of traveling in a still largely unfamiliar form of transportation? Safety factors had been the decisive consideration. Since the idea was to attract people, landings would have to be in or near populated areas. People unfamiliar with a helicopter might stray into its path, or, once it had landed, might wander into the whirl of its rotor blades and be injured or killed. Candidate's helicopter kills farmer. That would be the end of the candidate's hopes. It was fine to say that the landing area would be roped off and guarded, but among the crowd would be children. How could you be sure that a child might not dart out between the guards and be injured? As more and more such problems presented themselves to his imagination, Lyndon Johnson had decided that using a helicopter was simply too risky a gamble. But things had changed. Now he was losing everything. He took the gamble. On June 10th, a big four-passenger blue-and-white Sikorsky S-51, 60 feet long and with three 24-foot-long blades on its main rotor, piloted by James E. Chuders, an Air Force veteran who was one of the few pilots with substantial helicopter flying time, and carrying an ace mechanic, Harry Natchlin, left the Sikorsky aircraft plant in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and headed southwest. Cruising at about 90 miles an hour, it arrived at Love Field in Dallas 3 days later. The next day, a public address system was installed in the baggage compartment behind the seats. A large speaker was lashed to one of the landing gear struts. Lyndon Johnson for U.S. Senator was painted on both sides, and the day after that, Tudor's passenger arrived for a test flight. Tudor noticed that Johnson seemed to have remarkably little interest in the machine to which he was going to be entrusting his life. When they were up in the air, what Johnson was watching was not the control panel, but the faces of people on the ground. He was watching to see if their faces lifted to look at the helicopter. And they did. The week before the helicopter arrived had been a bad week, one of the worst, his aides say, in Lyndon Johnson's political life. His attacks on Stevenson had dismayed many of his advisers, and even worse, had failed to arouse interest among voters. Stevenson was shrugging off the attacks, and so was the press. The press was, in fact, less and less interested in the senatorial race. On June 13th, Margaret Mayer of the Austin American Statesman reported that with only 6 weeks to go, voters were still reacting to the candidate's efforts with a withering lack of enthusiasm. Johnson's announcement during that week that he would be the first candidate to use a helicopter in political history diffused the issue of its cost. He said that it and its pilot had been chartered and donated to his campaign by a group of 107 Dallas War veterans. It had been greeted with misgivings from most of his staff and with lack of interest in the press, except for occasional bursts of ridicule. A typical headline on a typically brief article about the announcement said, "Johnson to give 'em pie from the sky." Under the headline, "Looky, Ma, thar's that congressman," a Houston Post article said, "Asked what would happen if the sudden arrival of the helicopter stampeded some neighbor's cows through his kitchen, a spokesman for Johnson's headquarters said after a moment's thought, no comment. Petty said only, "I hope he doesn't get hurt and have to go back in the hospital." This reaction, however, demonstrated only that in politics, as in other fields, a revolutionary innovation may not be immediately recognized, as a stroke of genius it is. On June 15th, the Tuesday following his brief test flight, Johnson took off at dawn, flying east out of Dallas. At his first stop in Terrell, the landing site that had been selected by the advance man was a baseball diamond, so far outside town that the crowd was small. Johnson, recalls Busby, just flogged the man with his tongue. But at the next town to the east, Canton, the site was a vacant lot adjacent to the courthouse square, and the crowd was better. And at the next, Lyndale, over in East Texas now, Johnson told Tudors to try circling over the little town several times before landing. As the pilot did so, and the roar of the helicopter's Pratt & Whitney 985 engine filled Lyndale's streets, people poured out of their houses and stores, staring up at the sky. Then, when Tudors was over the Lyndale High School football field, Johnson told him not to descend immediately, but to hover above the field, holding the helicopter as stationary as possible, so that people would realize where he was going to land. And as the helicopter finally settled gently down, Lyndon Johnson could see latecomers running through the streets to see it at close range. Wednesday morning's newspapers carried stories about the senatorial candidate who, as one paper put it, was flitting around in a strange sort of flying machine that could go straight up and down and stand still in midair, and that looked like a flying windmill because of its tail rotor with its 3 4-1/2-foot-long blades. And there had been time now to place spot announcements on local radio stations. The word was also being spread by telephone, as East Texans who had seen the helicopter on the first day called relatives and friends in towns Johnson was to visit Wednesday to tell them not to miss it. All that day, Lyndon Johnson flew back and forth near the Louisiana border, over the thick pine forests that covered the rolling hills of the East Texas counties of Upshur, Cass, Lamar, and Marion, before heading off to Texarkana, at the northeasternmost corner of the state. When he passed over a town too small to merit a landing, the helicopter would hover over its main street while he shouted down through the loudspeaker, relying on notes from his advance men, "This is Lyndon Johnson, your candidate for United States Senator. How's the gang at Morgan's Drugstore?" Or, "Give my regards to Will Overton." And as he neared a town where a landing was scheduled, he could see below him not only people running through the streets toward the landing site, but in the countryside outside the town, plumes of dust moving along the dirt roads. Farmers had loaded their wives and children into their cars and were racing to see the helicopter land. By Thursday, the Associated Press had given the helicopter a name, the Johnson City Windmill. And the windmill was flying west, leaving the pine forests behind as the land below changed into blackland prairie. For hours, Tudors and Johnson flew along the broad Red River Valley on the state's northern border, hovering over some towns while Johnson shouted down from the air, and at intervals cutting south to land for speeches in Omaha, Mount Pleasant, Mount Vernon, Pagoda, New Boston, Clarksville, and Detroit. The last stop of the day was Paris, in Texas terms not a town but a small city, with its 24,000 residents. The streets of Paris, laid out following a fire that had all but leveled the city in 1916, were unusually wide. Wide as they were, however, as the Johnson City windmill settled to its landing, they were jammed, not only the sidewalks but the streets themselves, with people waiting to see it. That evening, Johnson gave a radio speech from a Paris station. Afterward, back in his hotel room, he made his nightly telephone call to his headquarters at the Hancock House. Claude Wilde had something to tell him. All that day, telephone calls had been pouring in from mayors and other public officials, not only in East and Northeast Texas, but all across the state, requesting that the itinerary for the flying windmill include their town. Communities that generally had little interest in a visit from a politician were asking, in some cases almost pleading, for a visit from Lyndon Johnson. With the exception of Coke Stevenson, candidates for the United States Senate did not generally travel with only one or two assistants, and certainly this candidate didn't. He needed at least one secretary, more than one speechwriter, he was, after all, giving both morning and evening radio addresses daily, as well as a man, Woody, to carry his suitcases, his boxes of monogrammed shirts and Countess Mara ties, his traveling case crammed with throat sprays and lozenges, skin ointment, and pills. Now he needed, in addition, a helicopter mechanic and someone familiar with the aircraft's landing requirements to be on hand at each stop to arrange vital crowd control precautions. The microphone he used for speeches on the ground had proved unsuitable for mid-air speeches because it picked up too much noise from the helicopter motor, so a second, more sensitive microphone was installed and hooked up to the loudspeaker lashed to the landing gear. A radio engineer from KTBC was needed to keep both microphones in working order. And he now decided, a radio announcer, he selected KTBC's Joe Phipps, to announce his arrival from the air as the helicopter was coming into land. He wanted everything. Everything included, of course, sound trucks to tour towns to prepare their inhabitants for his coming. You could do every street in these little towns twice in an hour, an aide recalls. And to the astonishment of even his most hardened aides, he wanted a band, a hillbilly band. Was a helicopter a drawing card? Well, so was a band. A band playing at the landing site for an hour or so before the landing would help attract a crowd. He wanted a band. And whereas Phipps and perhaps one other person could fit into the helicopter, the band, the mechanic, and the speechwriters, and the rest of the entourage would have to travel by cars, cars which could not keep up with the helicopter. A score of unanticipated problems further complicated logistics, and although the red and blue tank trucks of the Umbel Council, Alvin Wirtz, were supposed to be positioned along the helicopter's route, they were continually missing connections. Inability to prevent children from swarming around the helicopter and turning its valves necessitated a safety check after each stop. But the helicopter was worth all the trouble. By the second week, the routine of advancing it had become more thorough. Residents of each town it was to visit could hardly have avoided reading about it, either in their local weekly newspaper, which would be filled with advertisements and articles, often written by Johnson's staff, or in their mail, for each delivery seemed to contain a reprint of another newspaper article on the flying windmill, or another letter or postcard reminder of the time of its arrival, or in the flyers that seemed to be pressed into their hands on every shopping trip to town. They could hardly have avoided hearing about it, either on the radio, in spot announcements that were repeated over and over on the local station, or on their telephone. For Johnson advance men, arriving in a small town, simply went through the skinny local telephone directories name by name until every resident had been contacted. Or from their children, who would come home to announce that school was being let out for the day so that they could see this modern aeronautical marvel. Or from Johnson campaign workers who came to their door to tell them about it. People could hardly avoid seeing Johnson's picture, too, for Johnson was dispatching men to place posters in shop windows and on trees, urging his workers on with the same phrase he had used in previous campaigns. I want it so you can't wipe your ass on a piece of paper in that town that hasn't got my picture on it, recalls one of these campaign workers. He said he wanted posters up on every light pole, and he meant every light pole. I was driving with him once, and there was one pole, just one pole, without a picture of him, and my God, I never heard one human being talk to another human being like he talked to that poor guy who had missed that pole. By the day on which the flying windmill was scheduled to arrive, these small towns, in which there was so little to disturb the ordinary round of life, and the surrounding countryside, had been made to feel that its visit would be an extraordinary event. As a sound truck roamed the town that day, reminding its residents that it's coming at 3 o'clock, the Johnson City windmill, the flying windmill, the plane that can stand still in midair, the plane that can fly backwards, it's going to be landing on the high school field. Come meet your next senator, Congressman Lyndon Johnson. Small boys would ride their bikes over to the landing site and leave them sprawled on the ground while they played and waited. The old men who ordinarily lounged around the courthouse square would saunter slowly over, determined to be unimpressed. The town's businessmen and farmers and ranchers from the countryside would arrive in twos and threes, standing talking with their hands on their hips and their big hats pushed back on their heads, and mothers would come carrying their babies. There would be quite a crowd. And then people would hear the hum in the sky. They would generally hear it some minutes before they could actually see the helicopter, but finally someone would shout, "There it is, over yonder!" And someone else would shout, "Look, it's coming!" And people would begin pointing to the dot in the sky that was growing rapidly larger. As it drew closer, the hum became the distinctive, rhythmic, beating, chopping sound of the rotor blades flailing through the air. And then the helicopter was overhead, the roar of its engine filling the sky, the long blades whirling, gleaming blue and white in the sun, seemingly as big as a house, and indeed 60 feet long and 14 high, with those three long rotor blades, about as big as many of the stores in those little towns. And as it slowly descended, the roar of its engine, revving up to full power to hold the chopper steady, would become even louder, and the onlookers would be caught in the wind from those long, whirling blades. Men would grab their hats to keep them from blowing off. Women would put one hand to their heads to keep their hair in place, and would hold their skirts down with the other. Mothers clutched their babies in their arms. Fathers reached for their sons' hands and held them tight. The helicopter would settle to the ground in a last roar, a swirl of dust and pebbles swept into the air by its blades. A flurry of advance men would rush to guard the tail rotor, and then the motor would be cut off. And for a moment there was silence. Says the reporter, Margaret Mayer, "Coming down on those rural people in those little towns who'd never seen anything like it, with that tremendous roar and the dust swirling up, it was an awesome thing. As it was approaching, there was a lot of hurry-up, latecomers rushing to get there. But as it actually started to come down, there was silence, the silence of awe." And then the door of the helicopter would slam open. A long arm would swing out into the silence, holding a broad-brimmed, light-gray Stetson hat, and then, in a sweeping gesture, would fling the hat into the crowd. And out into the silence stepped Lyndon Johnson. The people, except for the small boys running to retrieve the hat, would be standing as if stunned, but Johnson didn't wait for them to come to him. In 3 or 4 long strides, while the rotor blades were still slowly revolving above him before coming to a halt, he would be out among them, reaching for hands, and after he had shaken a few, he would step back to the side of the chopper, where a wooden box would have been set up for him as a platform, don his microphone harness, and begin his speech, standing beside the machine that looked even bigger close up, and beside the huge white letters of his name. After the speech, announcer Phipps would take over the microphone and talk. "Come meet Congressman Johnson. He's been a friend of the people of this district. He got them lights. He got them roads. He will be a friend to all the people of Texas." While Johnson circulated through the crowd, shaking hands, men and boys would walk over to the helicopter. Watching them, Harry Natchlin saw that they all wanted to put their hands on it. To the mechanic's astonishment, many, not knowing what to do with the aircraft, did what they would have done with an unfamiliar automobile, kicked the helicopter's tires as if testing them for soundness. The boys and girls crowded around Natchlin asking questions. "How fast does it fly? What makes it go forward? Can it really go backward? Can it really go sideways? What does a tail propeller do?" There was drama in the takeoff, too. "The blades of the tail rotor came down pretty close to the ground," Natchlin recalls, "so Phipps, would be shouting through the helicopter's public address system, "Get back! Get those kids back! Watch out for those blades!" When a space had been cleared, shooters would start the engine and the roar would begin, and the blades would begin to creak and turn and beat the air again. The dust would lift and swirl, and the townspeople would back away. The Johnson City windmill would lift off the ground in a roar that was one of the loudest noises they had ever heard, rise straight up about 10 feet, and then circle higher into the sky. As the crowd watched, shooters would put on a little show over their heads, making 360-degree turns on a dime, wheeling the aircraft sharply to the left and the right, flying backwards or sideways. They were the most modest of maneuvers, really, Woodward says. He wasn't doing any trick stunts or anything, but to see an airplane fly backwards. When Woodward had been a little boy, his grandfather had taken him to see Charles Lindbergh land in Abilene during his triumphal tour of the United States in the Spirit of St. Louis, the plane in which he had flown the Atlantic. Today, with television and all, kids don't get thrilled anymore, but then, that helicopter was new and revolutionary and different. These small towns, they had so few events in their lives. This was an event. To see that helicopter come in thrilled those kids the way I'd been thrilled to see the Spirit of St. Louis. It was a real event in their lives. And then the little show would be over. Suddenly the helicopter would whirl and clatter away across the sky, a tiny dot disappearing, leaving behind comments that seemed to be the same in every town. Natchlin and Woodward and other men who followed the helicopter would remember them decades later. "Did you hear that chop-chop? That's why they call it a chopper. Did you feel that wind? Boy!" In those fundamentalist small towns, people were reminded of something in the Bible. Recalls a Blanco woman. After it, the helicopter, left, a Bible student said that the Bible says that people will float through the air. He said, "This is just the beginning. This is the beginning of a new era. We will see all sorts of changes from now on." The sound truck had left as soon as the helicopter appeared, of course, racing off, not for the next town, two or three trucks were leapfrogging towns in order to keep up with the helicopter, but for the town after that or the one after that. Some of the cars carrying advance men would have left before Johnson finished shaking hands to get a head start. But other drivers, including most of the reporters, would wait until the helicopter took off. Then they would pull out in a cloud of dust, trying frantically to keep up with the machine roaring overhead, not wanting to lose it. Because between his stops in towns, Lyndon Johnson was putting on quite a show. When flying over a largely empty landscape between towns, he saw ahead of him a group of men, five or six members of a railroad track repair crew working on a track, for example. He would jab a forefinger downward, and shooters would land beside them. Johnson would jump out, run over to them, shake their hands, hug them, and give them his campaign leaflets, and then run back to the helicopter and roar up into the air again, leaving the men staring after him. Sometimes the reaction of such targets of opportunity to the totally unexpected roar from the sky and the abrupt descent upon them of the weird-looking machine was not one of unbridled enthusiasm. In East Texas, for example, a dozen cotton choppers, seeing the flying windmill suddenly wheel and head for them, dropped their hose and ran in terror for the shelter of a nearby wood. Such reactions, however, did not deter the candidate. The helicopter was too fast for the cotton choppers. Before they could reach the wood, it was above them. As they froze in their tracks, he shouted down over the microphone, "Hello down there! This is your friend Lyndon Johnson, your candidate for the United States Senate. I hope you'll vote for me on primary day. And bring along your relatives to vote, too." The targets did not have to be as large as these groups. As the helicopter charged across the vast plains of West Texas, in particular, anything moving on the flat, featureless brown landscape below could be seen for miles, and Lyndon Johnson sometimes seemed to be following the rule that if it was moving, he shook its hand. The pilot, asked once how often Johnson made him land for a handshake, replied, "Wherever we saw more than two people and a big dog." Nothing in his path could escape. Was there an isolated farmhouse ahead? Into the midst of a peaceful farm setting, wife in her kitchen, baking perhaps, farmer milking under a tree, the S-51 would suddenly swoop with the Pratt and Whitney roaring. "The chickens thought it was a bird coming down to get them," Busby recalls. "They would go berserk, flying up and hitting the fences." Cows would gallop awkwardly away in panic to the farthest end of the pasture, the milk bucket having been kicked over. horses would squeal and rear in their stalls. And there in the front yard, broad smile on his face, campaign brochures in hand, would be a man saying, "Howdy, I'm Lyndon Johnson, your candidate for United States Senator. Just dropping in to say good morning." Merely because a town was too small to merit a landing didn't mean that it would be ignored. Not if it lay in the path of the Johnson City windmill. Approaching some tiny hamlet in the middle of nowhere, tutors would be ordered to hover above it. A great voice would come down out of the sky. "Hello down there," it would say. And as people ran out of homes or stores to stare open-mouthed up at the helicopter, the voice would continue. "This is your friend Lyndon Johnson of Johnson City, your candidate for the United States Senate. Just saying good morning." Thanks to the efficiency of his office staff, some of the residents were greeted by name. "Hello there, Mr. Sam Price. This is your friend Lyndon Johnson. I'm sorry we can't land today, but I want you to know that I'm up here thinking of you, and I sure do appreciate your kind letter and comments. I just want you to be sure and tell your friends to vote for me at election time." For the press, of course, or at least for those members of it willing to drive fast enough to keep up, this made good copy. Hovering his helicopter close to the red farmland, a reporter wrote, Johnson exchanged greetings with many workers in the fields. Flying low over a dusty road near Montgomery, the Johnson City windmill caused an old-fashioned buggy to burst into a spirited trot. Not since Pappy's Hillbilly Band had the folks in the Piney Woods had such a show. After a day racing along the Rio Grande, another wrote, Johnson brought people rushing out of their homes and places of business as he circled cities in the thickly populated valley, waving his hat and urging the people to come and see him speak. Seeing the helicopter start to descend between scheduled stops, reporters jammed on the brakes, pulled over to the side of the road, ran across the fields to be on hand when Johnson talked to a farmer or to a group of field workers, and that night wired details of the conversation to their city desks. Coverage became more and more dramatic. Articles talked of his fast-moving campaign, his whirlwind campaign, of the great excitement and crowds blocking the street when he landed in a town, of the people gaping as the whirly bird went through its routines. The datelines, with the Johnson City windmill at Ballinger, with the flying windmill at Dermot, picked up the spirit. The headlines got bigger and blacker. Johnson's copter heads for Georgetown. Johnson stumps cotton pickers via helicopter. Johnson and helicopter to be in Tarrant today. Johnson in 24 public appearances in day. In a campaign which had made little news, there was big news now. Not the import of the candidate's speech, but the vehicle in which he arrived to deliver it. The helicopter was, in fact, national news. Time magazine, for example, reported, in an article headlined Hello Down There, that Long Lyndon Johnson, one of Texas's most ebullient congressmen, has introduced the first new gimmick in Texas politics since the Hillbilly Band and the Free Barbecue. Out in the bottoms and the backcountry, the Johnson City windmill wowed the citizenry. The pro-Stevenson Dallas News acknowledged that the Senate race had become the campaign of the flying windmill. And, of course, the bigger the headlines became, the bigger the crowds became, each fueling the other. On the final day of June, Johnson's first stop was in the central Texas town of Bangs. The population of the town was 756. Reporters, making a person-by-person count of the attendance, found more than 700 people waiting when tutors set the S-51 down in Bangs's main street. And the Austin American Statesman reported that was the smallest crowd of the morning. At small towns and large towns, Johnson crowds far exceeded expectations, the American Statesman said. In Coleman, where 2,500 of the town's 7,500 people jammed onto Main Street to see the helicopter, sheriff's deputies and Johnson's advance men had to push people back into stores to clear enough space for it to land. Day after day, rural Texans were coming to see the Johnson City windmill in numbers such as had come to see no previous candidate in Texas history. No candidate, that is, except one. Pappy O'Daniel had drawn such crowds, and past the biscuits Pappy had won every race he entered. Thanks to the helicopter, statewide campaigning in Texas, which had always been a candidate's nightmare, had suddenly become a candidate's dream. All at once, those terrible Texas distances had virtually evaporated. Now all at once you were freed of those rutted, bumpy rural roads and were cutting effortlessly cross-country, over hills, and rivers, and lakes. And now when you approached a town in which a campaigner would once have been apprehensive that no one except a handful of campaign workers and a score of voters would be waiting to hear him, now as the helicopter neared the town, Johnson would suddenly see, on the single main street or around the patch of green which from the air signified the courthouse square or the high school football field, not scores of people, but hundreds. And these people wouldn't be standing around with the traditional studied, blank-faced, small-town indifference that ordinarily made speaking to them difficult. Circling the town, Johnson would see people running through the streets so as not to miss his arrival. And as he hovered and began to descend, he looked down on a sea of upturned faces, people waiting for him. What politician, what human being, would not have been exhilarated by such a response? Lyndon Johnson, always elated by the slightest sign of respect or affection from the public, was exhilarated, particularly after a day of touring his own 10th congressional district, flying over the hill country in which he had spent the youth of anxiety and shame and humiliation that made respect and affection so necessary to him. Heavy rain fell all that day in the 10th district, but rain couldn't keep the people away. 100 people were waiting for the Johnson City windmill on the lawn of the high school in Bastrop on the plains below the hill country, a sizable crowd for Bastrop, and there were about 200 in the courthouse square in Giddings. Before the next stop at Brenham, the helicopter was delayed for half an hour because a fuel truck did not arrive on time, but when he reached Brenham, the crowd was still there. Then the helicopter headed west toward the Perdinalis Valley. Along the roads on which he had worked as a laborer, harnessed like a mule, a long caravan of cars raced after him, for the regular entourage had been supplemented by some dozen campaign aides who had driven out from headquarters in Austin. The aides sped through the hills blowing their horns, every car bearing tied to its radiator a big picture of him, and overhead the helicopter circled each town it passed. Stonewall, where his father had lost the Johnson Ranch forever. Johnson City, where young Lyndon and his brother and sisters had lived out the rest of their youth in dread of losing their home there, too. Fredericksburg, where Lyndon had been beaten up at the dance. San Marcos, where Carol Davis had refused to marry him. The big helicopter circled each town again and again, shooters banking the aircraft so that as the townsfolk came out on their front lawns and into the streets, they could not miss the name Lyndon Johnson written in such big letters on its sides. The rain was heavier now, and visibility was limited, but when he got close enough to Taylor to see the high school football field, he saw some 300 automobiles parked there. The helicopter came down on the far side of the field, away from the cars. The people waded through the mud to reach him. Another crowd, huge by hill country standards, was waiting in Georgetown, and at the end of his speech there, he held a little press conference. "Did flying in the helicopter make him uneasy?" one reporter asked. "No," Johnson replied, "it gives me confidence." "Was he tired from the long day's campaigning?" another reporter asked. "Happy tired," Johnson said. "I know I am sweeping up votes like a whirlwind. I just feel it in the crowds." Heading back for Austin, where he was to spend the night, he passed over the little town of Round Rock. Ordering tutors to circle lower and then lower still and then to hover over Main Street, Johnson picked up the microphone and leaned out the window. The helicopter was low enough so that he could see the individual faces of people he knew staring up at him, mouths agape, and he called to them by name. He had invited Houston Post correspondent Jack Gwynn to ride this leg of the trip with him, and Gwynn was to report, "We were close enough to witness smiles of astonishment on the faces of the citizens." Landing at Municipal Airport in Austin, Johnson was greeted by a roaring crowd of supporters. Among them was his fellow Congressman John Lyle of Corpus Christi. "That thing sure makes a lot of noise," Lyle said. "That thing sure gets a lot of votes," Lyndon Johnson replied. The helicopter was not the only cause of Johnson's elation as June drew to a close and the campaign entered the final month before the primary. The other was a mistake, a grave one, made by his normally cautious opponent. The Texas chapter of the American Federation of Labor, meeting in Fort Worth, endorsed Coke Stevenson for senator, and Stevenson did not repudiate the endorsement. The AFL endorsement was to prove one of the great ironies in Texas political history. It was given not out of enthusiasm for the ex-governor, who had tacitly supported the Brown and Root-backed anti-labor Manfred bills, but out of deep hostility toward Lyndon Johnson. For years, Johnson had assured Texas labor leaders that he was a new dealer, 100% for labor's great friend Roosevelt. Then, believing that Johnson was what he said he was, the embattled, struggling unions of Texas had gone to him for help, and had found no help at all. Since FDR's death, moreover, in his stance against Truman's fair deal and his support for the Taft-Hartley Act, Johnson had openly opposed their aims. And his alliance with the hated Herman Brown had convinced them that while Stevenson had resisted them, Johnson had deceived and betrayed them. They saw their endorsement now as an opportunity for revenge. But their action was to backfire. So weak were unions in Texas, utterly unable even in the cities to mobilize their members, that their support could not help, could only hurt, a candidate. Anti-union sentiment was fierce in rural Texas, which identified unions with labor racketeers, big city corruption, big city ethnic groups. A widespread theme in the state's monolithic press, expressed in 295 editorials during a four-month period in 1948, was that strikes should be abolished because they were part of a communist conspiracy to overthrow America. When Stevenson learned by telephone of the unexpected endorsement, he was so shocked that, recalls reporter Charles Boatner, who happened to be traveling with Stevenson and Bob Murphy that day, after the former governor returned to the car, he just seemingly for 10 minutes didn't say a word, and then he said, "Well, I'm going to accept it. It will do me less harm to accept it than to fight it." Attempting in later years to understand their enigmatic old man's failure to repudiate the endorsement, Murphy and advisers such as Ernest Boyette would speculate that his reasons were less political than personal. Every time he switched on the radio in the car, it seemed, he heard a Johnson speech or a Johnson advertisement calling him a do-nothinger or an old man. "He never said a word," Murphy recalls, "just sometimes he'd roll down the window and spit." But those few men who had an opportunity to observe Stevenson during the campaign saw that his contempt for Johnson had been confirmed, and that dislike for his opponent had turned into something deeper. He felt there was no way he could lose much of the conservative vote, Boyette says, and he thought that maybe with it, the endorsement, he could pick up some of the liberals as well and really rub it in. And by this time he really wanted to rub it in to Lyndon. Whatever the reason, however, Stevenson's failure to repudiate the endorsement gave his opponent's campaign something it needed, an issue. Peace, preparedness, and progress hadn't caught on, and neither had anything else Johnson had tried. A helicopter could draw people to see a candidate, but he needed an argument to convince them they should vote for him. Now he had one. In the previously invulnerable armor of Coke Stevenson, there had appeared a chink. Lyndon Johnson's college debating partner, Elmer Graham, could have warned Stevenson what would happen next. The strong point of Lyndon's debating style, Graham says, was his devastating instinct for the jugular, his knack of finding a weak point in the other team's argument, and once he had found it, making the most of it. Johnson issued a statement charging that the endorsement was the result of a secret deal. "Labor leaders made a secret agreement with calculating Coke that they couldn't get out of me," he said. "A few labor leaders who do not soil their own clothes with the sweat of honest toil have met in a smoke-filled hotel room in Fort Worth and have attempted to deliver the vote of free Texas working men. I think the laboring men should ask their leaders why they wanted the unions to endorse a candidate who did not have the courage to sign or veto the state's vicious anti-labor law when he was governor." The labor leaders made it worse by rising to Johnson's bait. The AFL convention had not endorsed Coke Stevenson because of any deal, one AFL leader, Wallace Riley of Dallas, said the next day. It had endorsed him because his opponent was Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson, by his years of support of anti-labor bills in Congress, has disqualified himself in the eyes of the working people of Texas. After Riley offered a resolution terming Johnson's statement a deliberate lie, the 600 boiling mad delegates, the Dallas News reported, jumped to their feet, roaring in anger and shaking their fists as they approved it. But the headlines which reported their action, "Infuriated AFL Delegates Vote to Get Johnson," only helped the man they hated. Then Johnson sharpened the charge. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.